Well, I've lost my voice, and I'm the last speaker, so hopefully I can keep it going for 15 minutes here. I lost it yesterday and I didn't get it back. Okay, so I'm Bob Edmonds from the University of Washington College of Forest Resources, and I have my co-authors, Jessica Taylor, Daniel Vogt, and Richard Bigley from the Washington DNR. And Jessica has a poster back there if you wanted to see more of this. So, headwater streams, how much protection do they need? So, how important are headwater streams? Well, we know there's a lot of them out there in the landscape. They're small in size, but they can comprise a lot of the stream mileage. They're high in biodiversity. Obviously, what happens in them will affect downstream processes, so there are accumulative effects. And they're certainly sources of organic and inorganic nutrients to the drainage network below them. And we know that they would influence stream network temperature and sediments and a variety of other processes. So headwater streams have been studied for quite a long time in forested areas, and here's a map that shows some major watershed studies in the U.S. that started as early as 1910 in southern Colorado. And most of these were looking at the effects of forest harvesting on water and nutrients. And a lot of them have continued on. And the closest one that we have here is the H.J. Andrews in number two there. It started in 1948 and is still continuing on. And there's a lot of benefit to these long-term monitoring projects, particularly looking at the effects of management activities and things like air pollution. And that's certainly been true for those in the eastern United States. Hubbard Brook in number nine there started in the 1950s. So if you're trying to look at indicators of change with respect to management activities, you can look at things like stream flow, nitrate concentrations and losses, and changes in nitrogen form, temperature, and sediments, and that's commonly been done for these long-term monitoring studies, but you could also look at biological activities, so we'll talk about that in a bit. So why have people looked at nitrogen? Well, many stream studies are focused on nitrogen because it's a limiting nutrient both for plants and in streams, and in its excess it's a pollutant. So you can have too much of a good thing. So studying nitrogen cycling gives an understanding of natural ecosystems functioning and the influence of practices like clear cut harvesting, as I mentioned. And the stream nitrogen form also might be an important indication of change, particularly if you have nitrate versus dissolved organic nitrogen in the system. So we'll look at that in a minute. And certainly aquatic populations are sensitive to things like nitrate, so we know that certain salamander species in the West are sensitive to nitrogen concentrations of less than a milligram per liter, which is considerably less than the drinking water standard of 10 milligrams per liter. So we could see ecological effects below the standards that we set for ourselves. So I want to talk about two studies here, two headwater stream studies. The first one is looking at old-growth headwater streams in West Twin Creek in the Olympic National Park, which is essentially trying to look at what happens in a system that hasn't been managed. What can we learn from that that might be useful with respect to looking at the influence of clear-cut harvesting? And then do we need to actually protect these streams with riparian buffers when you're talking about managed ecosystems? So the second study I'll talk about is one that we're doing in the Capitol Forest near Olympia. So we're contrasting the results of those two studies. So the West Twin Creek study is in the Ho River drainage out there on the west side of the Olympic Peninsula. And we started this study in 1984, and unfortunately it was finished in 2004. We could never find the money to keep it going again, but it actually started as part of the acid deposition program in the early 1980s, where people were looking at the effects of acid precipitation on forested ecosystems and streams. And we were the control site, so supposedly the cleanest site in the lower 48 states. So the site is actually located on the side of that wall on the left side of the diagram there, and this is the Ho River Valley, looking up towards Mount Olympus. And it's a 58-hectare watershed that's located in old-growth forest, large old trees. The oldest trees are over 800 years old. And there's a weir at the bottom of the watershed, and we were able to look at stream chemistry and also quantify the amount of water coming out with a stilling well that was located at that site. So these headwater streams that I'm talking about basically are non-fish-bearing streams, and they're typically around a meter or so at low flow or less. And, of course, at high flow, particularly out there in the Olympics, they can be considerably higher than or wider than 1 meter. So that's a typical headwater stream. So if you look at what happened, in this case, we're starting in 1986 through 2000, and nitrate is on the bottom graph there. You can see that nothing terribly exciting happened between 1986 and 1993, and then suddenly there was this increase in 1994 that lasted for a couple of years, and went up to about 0.7 milligrams per liter, which is not particularly high, but it did have a noticeable effect on the pH of the stream. So the upper graph shows pH. In fact, we did actually find some pH values as low as about 4.5 during that period. So the question is, what on earth would cause the nitrate to change from that even pattern to one that suddenly jumped up like that? We also had a debris flow as part of this natural system that occurred in 1999. So it was interesting that we had these two events happen in this pristine environment, which we probably wouldn't have noticed if we hadn't been doing this long-term monitoring. So there's the debris flow. That's before the debris flow, and that's after the debris flow. And this was a very long thing. It was about a kilometer long, I think, if I remember. And it was very dramatic. It probably would have killed anybody who was right there at the time. It moved a huge amount of water around. So we would have expected to have some impact of that debris flow on the stream chemistry, particularly nitrate, and we didn't actually see it. So what was going on in that 1993, 1994, 1995 period relative to what happened at the debris flow where we didn't see any effect, even though there was a huge visual effect on the landscape? Well, it turns out that this actually was an Asian air pollution event that came across the Pacific Ocean. And it changed the system from one that was dominated or had a high proportion of dissolved organic nitrogen to one that was nitrate dominated. And so nitrate domination essentially is an indication of change in the system, which shows that there was basically a pollution effect where you switch from DON to nitrate. And that's something to look at to see whether you've got a disturbed system or not. This same sort of thing has been noticed in South America, in the temperate rainforest down there, where dissolved organic nitrogen is a dominant form of nitrogen. So that gives you a little background in terms of what you expect in a pristine system. What happens then when you clear-cut harvest? And do we need to protect these headwater streams using riparian buffers? And so this study was done in the Capitol Forest in Waddell Creek, and it's done relative to what happened at Hubbard Brook, which is one of those watersheds that I mentioned before back on the East Coast, where they harvested an herbicide watershed 2, and you got this dramatic increase in nitrate from about 1 or 2 milligrams per liter, which is sort of in the level that we were looking at in the old growth, to about 60. So there's about 30 times increase in nitrate in that particular system. Well, it turns out it really wasn't the harvesting that did it so much as the herbiciding, where they kept the vegetation off the site. And if you get vegetation back on the site relatively quickly, you never see those levels of nitrate, and we certainly didn't observe that in our study. So the question then is, do these systems actually need protection in the upper parts of watersheds? And the latest forest and fish agreements have given this kind of protection to fish-bearing streams, type F streams, where you've got a core zone, an inner zone, an outer zone. You can do harvesting in the inner and outer zones. The maximum width is about 210 feet or so on either side of the stream, which is a little less than the 800 feet that Bob Nyman was proposing this morning. So those kinds of streams actually are getting protection, but above that, in the non-fish-bearing streams, you have the NP, which is the perennial waters, non-fish-bearing perennial waters, and above that you've got seasonal waters. So do these actually need some protection? And the NP waters have been given some protection, particularly in hot spots in the environment like seeps and springs, and perhaps some parts of the stream might be buffered, and the object is to have 50 feet on either side of the stream and about half that watershed actually protected by buffers. But the NS waters don't get any protection except for the 30-foot area where you can't operate machinery, but you can still harvest right across those streams. So here's a couple of examples of what this might actually look like on the landscape. Here's an area that would have received a buffer. These might be the seeps or hotspots on the landscape that would be protected. And here, as you get up in here, these would be the seasonal areas with no protection at all. So the question is, do these things actually function in any way that you can actually detect on the landscape? Of course, they're also quite vulnerable to blowdown as well. So this is sort of an experiment that's being conducted right now in Waddell Creek. Elevation's about 180 to 396 meters. These are very small watersheds. They're only 1 to 8 hectares in size. And we have buffered control, traditional clear cuts at 15 years and traditional cuts at 5 years. And then also the Waddell Creek is a monitoring station right there. So here's a few little, they're very small weirs on very small watersheds, and they have pressure transducers, and they measure the temperature of the water. And as you can see, they're quite small. So there's a weir in every one of those watersheds. So here's an example of a buffered watershed, a watershed we call Tums. So there's the watershed, and that's the buffer. So the question is, what does that actually do? So in terms of nitrate concentrations, the buffered actually has higher nitrate concentrations, up to almost 1 milligram per liter, than the control or the open 5-to-5-year-old canopy. So these concentrations are, of course, still very low. 1 milligram per liter is very low. And probably not going to cause much in the way of ecological effects, although it's getting up to the level of what salamanders might be sensitive to. You notice that the open canopy is actually lower than the control. So the control is a 70-year-old forest, Douglas fir, and in this case, the effect of clear cutting isn't very obvious because it actually has the lowest concentration except for that one particular point there. Now, we've continued this on through 2007 and we're following this through time just to see whether these patterns repeat themselves. We assume that the reason the open canopy one, the 5-to-7-year-old stands, don't have high nitrate concentrations is that trees are growing very actively and the vegetation is taking up whatever nitrate might be available there. But the reason that the buffered ones are so high is a whole bunch of red alder in that buffered zone. So if it had Douglas fir alone, it probably wouldn't be as high. So here's a summary of what's happened in those watersheds. Here's the buffered one. Nitrate still is the dominant form over dissolved organic nitrogen, and ammonium is about the same there. But the 5-to-8-year-old clear cut is relatively low in concentrations of nitrogen. This is the control here. So it's actually between the buffered and the 5-to-8-year-old one. And Waddell Creek, which is the one that's looking at the whole watershed, is this one here. So it's actually slightly higher in nitrate than the buffered one, perhaps reflecting all the activities that are going on in that particular watershed. But in no case is the DON the dominant form like we found in the old-growth forest. So this would tell you that it's a disturbed system compared to the old-growth forest that probably would have been there. Now, there's also an interest here in actually figuring out how much nitrogen leaves these systems. And these numbers are very similar to what we found in that nitrate pulse that came in from Asian air pollution out in the Ho River Valley. So nitrate is about 9 here, and it was about 9 there. And similar numbers with respect to ammonium and DON. So it's only about 10.5, about 11 kilograms per hectare that's actually lost over that whole year period, which isn't very much, considering there are thousands of kilograms of nitrogen that are in that ecosystem. So in terms of depleting the bank account and a concern about loss of nitrogen and lowering productivity, this certainly doesn't seem to be a problem with this system, and all these other ones, of course, would be actually lower than that. So was there any effect on stream temperature? And you can see here that these are relatively cold streams, and the buffered stream did tend to have a little higher temperatures, but not a couple of degrees warmer. So apparently harvesting actually, and compared to the control, will cause the stream temperatures to elevate a couple of degrees, but not dramatically increase. Buffering doesn't seem to give you any great effect there. So in conclusions, the question is, are headwater streams being protected enough? Timber harvesting does not have a dramatic impact on the nitrogen concentrations, stream temperatures, and turbidity. And I didn't mention turbidity, but I actually have done some turbidity data looking at effects of harvesting. And we certainly know that you do get increased deposition as a result of harvesting. So a certain amount of sediment builds up behind these weirs. But it's not a dramatic increase, but it does occur. Buffered streams have slightly higher nitrate concentrations than clear-cut harvested and non-harvested stream because of the presence of red alder in that particular case. But the concentrations are still very low, and nitrogen discharge is not excessive. So the question then is, do they need more, less, or the same amount of protection? Perhaps this depends on what you measure. And if you just look at things like nitrogen concentrations and stream temperature and turbidity, it doesn't give you information with respect to things like stream invertebrates and salamanders. And this is the kind of thing that Jim Carr was arguing for this morning, that we need some index like his BIBI that could actually be universally applied to these kinds of things to get an idea of impacts. But just based on physical measurements and chemistry, you'd say that there's not very much effect so far and of harvesting of these streams, but buffering them doesn't seem to give them a tremendous amount of protection, perhaps except for the areas that might be hotspots on the landscape. So I was given the order to stop. I can't go on anyway. So I can ask you, what do you think?
Did you look at different buffer widths, or were you only using what the regulatory
No, it's only what the regular mandate. And, of course, there's all sorts of variations you could do with this, but you've got to find some place on the landscape to actually do it. And it's a fair amount of work to set up each of these streams with weirs and pressure transducers to keep them all going. But there's all sorts of variations on the theme.
Since these are such small streams, I just wanted to see what your opinion was on, perhaps it's because part of the reason might be because the streams are so small that just some 5 or 10 foot tall bushes that are happen to be growing up there could actually provide shade on these little 1 meter wide streams. What do you think about that?
Well, it could, because it would be low enough to do it. With the presence of the trees, which have stems, of course, means that the sun can actually come in at an angle, and these are fairly steep slopes. So it's not, basically, they're not getting any protection to the stream from the stems that are left there. If you could fill in the bottom part with understory somehow or other, you'd actually be getting some more protection. But just leaving the trees alone... it doesn't really give it very much protection as far as temperature goes. Now, the other question is, if you increase the temperature a couple of degrees, does it really matter if you're already below the threshold with respect to what the effects on fish?
I may have missed it at the very beginning, but what made you choose these parameters, given the climate changes and reduction of water in streams? Why didn't you look at, say, soil moisture or some different parameters?
Well, there are actually some pieces of the question. Sorry, I'm supposed to tell myself. Repeat the question. Why didn't we repeat it. why didn't we look at other parameters other than these, just these things in the stream, like soil moisture, soil temperatures, and other things? And we actually did. And there's a couple of graduate theses that have actually come out of that, trying to connect what's going on in the terrestrial environment to what's happening in the stream. So there is some additional data on those things. But you couldn't do it in 15 minutes.
Yes, you were considered organic debris. Wondering if you considered the contribution of wood to the outer ridges in buffered and non-buffered streams, especially during the reflow.
Yeah, well, that's certainly an important part of it. You know, how does the wood actually get into the stream? Does it move down from upslope to downslope through? And certainly you'd get some contribution during high flows of that nature. But we actually haven't looked at that particular piece, although we did we've had some of these streams harvested when we put the weirs in, and we ended up filled a whole bunch of woody debris on top of the weir. So that wasn't exactly what we had in mind there. But certainly the contribution of wood is something else that you could look at as well.
I'm just curious if you have any speculation why, when you look at the different temperatures across the examples that you gave, that the clear cut was no warmer than the control, they said, and was actually cooler than the buffer.
Right, yeah. Right, let me repeat the question as to why the differences in temperature in the various treatments, particularly the clear cut. And it's probably due to the fact that in the clear cut you're getting radiation losses, so it'll make it actually colder, and you're not getting re-radiation from the trees around it, so that might make the buffer actually slightly warmer. So there could be some impact of the energy budget associated with the stream-side vegetation that's actually causing that, and whether you're losing radiation. And the other problem is, are these things really replicates or not? Because it's very hard to replicate. They're all actually different from each other. We tried to get them sort of on the same slope, but they're all different sizes. And so replication is another question here. That's all we have time for. So now I can introduce Anne.